Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Circular Metabolism Podcast. I'm your host, Aristide, from Metabolism of Cities. In this podcast, we interview researchers, thinkers, policymakers, and practitioners to better understand the metabolism of our cities and how to reduce their environmental impact in a socially just and context-specific way. In the last episodes, we explored some alternative societal and economic models, such as degrowth, living well within limits, permacircularity, and we continue our quest by looking into post-growth. Today is a special day. I have the pleasure to talk with Tim Jackson about his new book, Post-Growth, Life After Capitalism, which I had the opportunity to receive from Polity Press. And I wanted to introduce Tim because you are, of course, a very versatile person. You are an ecological economist, but you also are a writer and a playwright. Since 2016, you have been the director of the Center of Understanding Sustainable Prosperity, so CUSP, and you have degrees in mathematics, in philosophy, in physics, so quite a happy mix that I'm very curious to talk about later on.
I'm glad you think that's a happy mix, Aristide. It's perhaps a rather strange mix for an economist.
Well, I think this tells a lot about how you write as well, and you are the author, of course, of Prosperity Without Growth, which is a book that has influenced a lot of people, including me. So I read it 10 years ago, back when it was a report, before it was a book. And it helped me kind of explore the relationship between material flows, GDP, prosperity, and how they're interlinked. And so I had the pleasure to read this book, which is it's a mix between history of economy, capitalism, science, philosophy, and a manifesto of how to build the next economy. So it's a really inspiring book, and you can find quotes of the Beatles, of Boltzmann, of Aristotle, Shakespeare, Stuart Mill, and many others in order to better understand what the good life is and what motivates us. So with all that being said, thank you very much, Tim, for being part of this podcast, and congratulations on your inspiring book.
Thank you.
Could you perhaps just give a short introduction of yourself? Tell us a bit more about the rationale behind this book.
I guess, in a way, I started out with circular economy and writing about circular economy. I guess kind of back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and I wrote a book in the mid-1990s called Material Concerns, which really tried to draw together a lot of the technological understanding of a circular economy, and situated it in our sort of search for the good life as well, if you like. And it was really out of that work and out of my sort of exploration of the limits of technology that I began to question the economic model more and more. And I found myself in the early 2000s as economics commissioner on the Sustainable Development Commission, which reported to the UK Prime Minister. And I sat down very early with the chair of that commission and said, you know, what should I best spend my time on while I'm in the commission? And the result of that actually was Prosperity Without Growth. It was kind of, we both decided it was a good time to have a serious look at the most obvious tension that we face as a human species, which is an expanding economy into a finite planet doesn't go. And it's almost so simple, you know, that kids can understand it, and certainly lay people can understand it. It's generally harder for politicians and economists
because of the dogma somehow.
But also because economists have a very different view. They're not rooted so much in the physical world, and they think that economic value isn't necessarily rooted in the physical world either. Up to a point that's true. Value is not the same thing as material throughput. And therefore, if you can continually dematerialize your economy, make it lighter and lighter, then you do have a chance. In principle, you have a chance of expanding your economy without trashing the planet. The difficulty is we've never done it. The challenge of doing it is absolutely enormous. And almost all of the triggers of the economy push in the wrong direction. And so that's really, you know, when I came to write Prosperity Without Growth, that was kind of the analysis that I developed during that. I had lots of mathematics in there, lots of looking at statistics, lots of thinking about the data, lots of empirical work. It was written as a policy report for a prime minister. Now, I'm not saying that prime minister was very happy to receive the report. He wasn't at all. In fact, I had just before it went out, I had a phone call from someone close to the prime minister's office who told me that he'd gone ballistic. So it was not a welcome report at all. It began a sort of conversation, actually, I think that people have been wanting to have. So even though, you know, our policy paymasters, if you like, were not very pleased to see the report and kind of wished it would go away, there came an enormous audience for that report suddenly out of nowhere after a week or so of complete dead silence, deafening silence, in which the policymakers tried to pretend it wasn't there. And after that, it just got downloaded, you know, over and over again by all sorts of people all over the world who wanted to have that conversation about whether a growth-based economy is really the right direction of travel. What else is there? How do we manage that tension and really think differently about the kind of society that we want to have? But as I say, it was a policy report to policymakers, and so it was written in policy language. And a few years ago, a couple of years ago, I had a conversation with someone for whom, like you, that report had been very influential, who sort of said to me, look, Tim, it's absolutely great. This kind of changed the way I think about my work. In fact, he left his job because of, not sure he thanks me for that, but he left his job from having read the book and sort of said, but I think you need to make this more accessible to more people. And so post-growth is partly about that. It's partly actually a response to that conversation and a sort of recognition actually that policy language is not always the most accessible for ordinary people, and that actually there's another job to be done, which is to think about our lives from the perspective of ordinary everyday people who don't think in policy terms, don't want data. I remember my mum saying to me at one point, well, there's a lot of graphs in it, aren't there, Tim? And I was like, yeah, mum, that's the point. But actually, you know, for someone who was an intelligent human being who could understand the philosophical points, actually that way of talking gets in the way. And I wanted to bypass that. I wanted Post-Growth to be a book which talked about ideas and talked about philosophies, but did it in a way that told stories that people could understand and that connected them therefore to what I think is actually a long, long train of thought that there are better ways to live. There's a different way of organizing society, that it isn't just all expand, and neither is it all fight. It's not all about competition. And I wanted post-growth to really to draw those together and to present, if you like, a portrait of a different way of thinking about society.
But it's funny, yeah, I think that the prosperity without growth also helped people like me, which were very data oriented, very dry, to get a glimpse of hope out of, you know, because we have reports since the 1970s with limits of growth and all of that tell us that we cannot continue in the same way. So that was a given, but you added the word prosperity, you added the word well-being, you added some extra notions that give us hope, that tells us, well, we're fighting for something. We're not just fighting for, well, we're fighting for survival, but we're also fighting for the good life, and we're fighting for, you know, something optimistic at the end of the day, which I find very reinvigorating. And I think in this, you also help people that are not interested into data, as you said, to understand that there are figures behind this. It's not just wishful thinking, is not just, you know, an optimist writing a manifesto to do civil disobedience. It's more, even if you kind of call for it because we are stuck within a system, there is science behind it. And I think that I agree.
I think that's really important too. I think it's it is partly because of what you said about where I come from. You know, I'm a kind of mathematician on the one hand, but I'm a playwright on the other, and actually I think you kind of need both those things to kind of make progress and to deepen our levels of thought about where we're going.
So where did your obsession with growth started?
You call it an obsession, Aristide. I'm not sure how obsessed I am with growth. I mean, actually, I'm a big fan of the GDP. It seems a really weird thing, but I think it's a clever construct from an intellectual point of view, because it brings together so many different parts of our economy, fits them into a puzzle. And so if you want to understand how an economy works, then the GDP can tell you something about it. And I think, you know, what's gone wrong is the idea that the GDP and the growth in the GDP is the only thing that we should be aiming for. And I suppose, you know, in my early work, interestingly, in some of the early work, I remember a report that I did very, very early on for Friends of the Earth. I basically accepted that we had to present our solutions in the context of a GDP that was growing. You can go back and find it. It was written in 1999. It was a piece of work on the relative carbon intensities of different energy technologies. And basically what we said was, you know, you can reduce this carbon and stay and still keep your 2% growth target or whatever it was at the time. I don't remember. And so I did, you know, I did start out accepting that dogma. And it was really only when I began to think about why things weren't changing that I began to question the dogma. I began to go back to that and say, you know, is that correct? And then one day, you know, I stumbled on the Index of Sustainable Economic Welfare, which Herman Daly and John Cobb had put together with Clifford Cobb in their book For the Common Good. And it was, to me, I mean, I am someone who likes those kind of pictures and responds to those graphics. And it was a very, very clear picture. It was a picture of GDP going up and up and up over 50 years and of the index, which they had constructed to reflect welfare, going up for a certain time and then beginning to flatten off and actually decline over the years. And it was such a graphic illustration, that division of those two lines. Yeah, GDP can go up and up and up, but actually well-being is not doing the same thing. And so one of my first instincts was, you know, I want to do that for the UK. And I did it for the UK, and then we did it for Sweden, and we contributed to, you know, a collection of indexes of sustainable economic welfare, lots and lots of lovely graphs, Mum, which showed, you know, began to show the same thing, that although we were getting more GDP, we're getting bigger economies, that wasn't making the world a better place. And that, I think, was the point at which, you know, I began to then understand that we had to confront that as a societal challenge and take it seriously, not just to say, you know, that's it, we don't need growth anymore, forget it. But because that's not a solution either in an economy in which everything is built around growth. So we have to, in a sense, see it as a task to unpick our own dependency on this growth in the GDP and to figure out how to do things better. A lot of that actually was in Prosperity Without Growth and the kind of thinking about the economy, thinking about enterprise, thinking about investment, thinking about the money system itself, thinking about all of those things and how you do them differently. That was kind of laid out in principle in Prosperity Without Growth. And it's part of what CUSP, my research center, is exploring in all sorts of ways, economic ways, philosophical ways, sociological ways, psychological ways, political science research that we do there is all dedicated to this task of actually teasing us out of this gross dependent society and thinking about a different way to build things. And then Post-Growth, the book, is a kind of homage to that idea, written hopefully, and you know, from what you said, I've been partly successful at least, in a way that people can grasp it as a story, as a meaningful story, and as the beginnings of a conversation about a different kind of society. And so in a way, it kind of, if you like, it was never an obsession with growth. It was, first of all, it was, yeah, growth is kind of the frame in which I have to do my work. Second is, why is it the frame I have to do my work? Third is, actually, we're in a really difficult societal challenge here. And fourth is, you know, a place where, even though I've called the book Post-Growth, actually it's a place of flight where we can flee from the assumptions of the past and free ourselves to imagine a different kind of future.
It's funny because I really enjoyed also the side stories kind of things that you have all around the book. And so you start with the story of was it Robert? I always forget.
Robert Kennedy, yeah.
Yeah, Robert Kennedy. Mm. And it was in 68, of course, at the same time in France, you had a massive movement as well. And he was a proponent of post-growth, which was mind-blowing for me that someone from the US would be someone like that.
And someone running for president.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
I mean, I was just, you know, I remember very distinctly, we were in the middle of doing, I think it was the UK Index of Sustainable Economic Wealth. Somebody discovered a recording of that speech at the University of Kansas. And it was, you know, for us as working on it, it was just, it was extraordinary. And we kind of, you know, almost had not known until that point that that recording was unearthed, that actually someone running for president of the US had made the same point 40 years before, or it wasn't 40 years at that point, but it's now 47, 48. So,
of course, unfortunately, he was assassinated. So we never know what would have happened in case he was
50. I'm sorry, my maths, you know, I'm obviously in the wrong. I'm not being that. It's for those listening and paying attention, 1968 is not 48 years ago. It's 53. Actually, it's 53 almost exactly when he made that speech 53 years ago.
But then you went down the rabbit hole and, you know, you pulled the thread and you saw that his advisors were Galbraith. And then the advisor, you know, the PhD advisor, Herman Daly, is Galbraith. If I understand correctly. And so there is
not quite, but he was, Galbraith was very, very influential both Herman's PhD supervisor himself. So I was fascinated. I mean, it was like, where did this come from in 1968 when growth rates were 4% and 5% per year? How come this guy comes along and says, actually, you know, growth's not all it's made out to be, folks? And so I was really fascinated by the ideas that I came from. And in some ways, thinking about it now, I think I was a bit arrogant about it because, you know, we have an arrogance in us about our own modernity. We think we are the most modern, most progressive, most forward-thinking part of society because we're at the cusp, we're at the forefront of it. So we must be the ones who are thinking best. Yeah. But actually, and that's one of the things, I suppose, about the stories in the book, the more you look, the more you find that actually these ideas have a legacy. And that legacy is the legacy of incredibly thoughtful, intelligent, poetic people who have been there before us. And that's a part of what I wanted to do. And it's, you know, when I began to discover the sort of roots of that speech that Robert Kennedy made, it really reinforced that point for me that we are sort of engaged in a kind of ongoing conversation about the kind of society that we want. And yes, people have been there before us. They have talked about those things. There's enormous knowledge locked up in history books, which is bad because not many people like history books that much. But it's, you know, if you can bring that alive and tell those stories, then we can connect ourselves not just to a future that we want, but to a past that's already been supporting us, even though we didn't know that we were being supported by these long dead people.
Yeah, and even, I mean, it seemed like a crime investigation when you went down this path. And it's funny that, well, Herman Daly was writing his article at the same time, more or less, of the speech, and these were not correlated. And that's also a human condition. Yeah.
It's almost like we're living inside a program, do you think? No, I'm not going that far. But I mean, that's kind of, you know, that's Elon Musk territory, I guess. But
Wait for it.
But it is, you know, there were moments during the writing of the book and during this exploration of ideas when I it felt so connected, those ideas across time. And, you know, through accidental occurrences of the same thing at the same time, like Herman Daly's paper and Bob Kennedy's speech. And I asked Herman himself, because I was fascinated, because I've met him a couple of times and I know him reasonably well because of the work that we've done. And so I asked him, you know, did you know about the speech at the time? And he said, no, I had no idea. which makes it even more extraordinary in a way. But there is a kind of sense, of course, in which, you know, ideas have their time in history and appear in different places. And so, you know, maybe something like that was going on. And then, of course, there were common sources. So the most obvious one was Rachel Carson's Silent Spring.
Of course.
And John Kennedy, who was Robert Kennedy's brother, was a huge supporter of Rachel Carson. So already in the DNA, actually, of the kind of Kennedy presidency, there was this care, this concern for the environment and a reflection on the kind of economy that we had and the kind of society we were becoming, and a lot of support for what I would now call, and you would probably now call, post-growth ideas. So that was, you know, it was a part of the kind of fascination of looking at these different people.
Well, it also gives a legitimacy to, you know, these thoughts. You're not just a radical thinker that out of the blue, you know, pulled the post-growth out of your hat, and that is it. It exists for a long time. There are philosophical values, there are economic values, there's a number of values that have existed, and we just need to reshape them, remake a puzzle out of old pieces, more or less, and make sense of our current contemporary challenges, because the challenges are similar, you know, over the ages. We had environmental challenges, we had societal challenges, but we kind of keep on pushing, trying to change more or less what is happening with more or less success. But it's also, you know, a root. It's not new, all of this. We're really, I think you also had the lockdown and the pandemic at the epicenter of your book as perhaps a trigger or perhaps a revival of some old instances. I don't know how.
It was impossible really to write that book at that time without at least partly anchoring it in the pandemic, partly because most of it was written in lockdown, but also because it is, of course, the most extraordinary thing to happen, not just to our economy, but to our society as a whole, you know, definitely in our lifetimes, my lifetimes, which is a little bit longer than yours, and indeed, you know, almost anyone alive has not really been able to kind of remember anything quite so extraordinary. And our kids are, you know, they're going to be living through and hopefully prospering after one of the most extraordinary events in the last century. So there was no sense in which I could kind of write the book without thinking about the pandemic, even though I started writing before. It sort of inevitably seeped into the way that I was thinking about the book, and also because it's had some really extraordinary lessons for the way that we think about the economy. You know, it's really has turned so many things on its head. First of all, most obviously, I suppose, that, you know, when push comes to shove, it's not wealth that matters so much as health. And that's a change in viewpoint. You know, it's a real switch in viewpoint. And it happened a year ago. We stopped prioritizing wealth and we began to prioritize health. And governments did what they had to do, and they did it more or less overnight. And they did it without any restrictions, and they paid for it through you know, mechanisms that they denied had ever existed. And so we kind of, in a way, it was giving us lessons about a post-growth economy in a way that no book ever could. And that was so inevitably, you know, I think there were lots of very key influences there. And then there was also this other thing, which about the pandemic, I think, which is that it's taught us something at least about ourselves as human beings, and you know, not just about the things that matter, but also about the things we struggle with. The lockdown, in some sense, is a kind of, you know, huge metaphor for the our own mortality and the temporality of our lives, and that there are certain kinds of limits on us, and that the way that we respond to those limits is really almost like our existential task. You know, it isn't an accidental thing that comes just because we have a pandemic and because we have to suddenly deal with an unexpected situation. There is a sense in which, and this was kind of, I mean, this is obviously my learning out of the pandemic. It's not everybody's, but it was certainly, it sort of reflected back at me in a sense that you know, ultimately our battle against limits is an existential one. And we have a choice in that. We either sort of try to bounce our way out of it and bound free, you know, in one bound he was free, and pushing at the frontiers of, I don't know, anything from overseas holidays to Mars, if you are of a certain kind of understanding about the frontier of human ingenuity. And yet, there are still limits to that, and there are limits to how many people can participate in that. We might get, if we're lucky, a few people to build a colony on Mars, but that's not about the lives and livelihoods and health of 8 billion people on planet Earth, and it's not about the quality of our environment. And so there's, you know, if we retreat from that frontier mentality and draw our sights back towards Earth, towards ourselves, towards the inner part of the human psyche, what do we find there? And it's one of the most extraordinary things is that we've lost sight of that journey, that inner journey. It seems to me, you know, we've been so focused on that outer journey. We've been so focused on that innovation. We've been so focused on the outer frontier that we've neglected parts of what it is to be human. And in a way, I think it's the same process that we've neglected our own history. If you're continually innovating, if you're continually searching for the new, you're not looking back anymore. You're not looking at the understandings of our grandparents. And therefore, we're losing the wisdom of that history itself brings to inform our lives. And there's sort of two sides of the same coin in a way, those things. That continual innovation loses sight of history, and continually bursting for the frontier loses sight of the inner game, if you like. One of the books that I cite in there, in pursuit of a kind of a quality which in psychology is called flow, the ability to really focus on something and concentrate on something, be carried away from it. And I was first introduced to that, interestingly, through playing tennis. There's a wonderful book called The Inner Game of Tennis. And it says a very obvious, very straightforward thing to someone, anyone who plays any kind of sport, that most of it is happening inside your head. Your sporting ability is partly, but only partly, about the physical and about what you can physically achieve. And most of it is happening inside your head. And that's where the battles are being fought. That's where you fall apart when everything goes wrong. And that's when it goes right, you really can achieve these kind of states of mind which go outside of the ordinary. So in a way, it's bizarre in a way that by coming back from the frontier and focusing in what's inside us, we actually burst out way further than that, the imagination of that frontier that we had in the first place. This is not physically going to Mars. And, you know, hands up to the people who have landed Perseverance rover on the surface of the red planet. It's a fantastic achievement. But there are other achievements that are more accessible to all of us. And it was a part of what I wanted to do, was to lay before people the possibility of that inner journey. It doesn't cost anything. It isn't material intensive. It doesn't give you instant gratification, but it's a part of almost a part of the soul of society. And it connects us to other people in ways that a competitive, materialistic, hedonistic lifestyle.
Well, it depends if you're heliporting to Davos, as you mentioned.
I have to say, if that's got to be a blast, hasn't it? That's got to be a real. Yeah.
but I think.
But we're not going to do it because it's so bad.
Not all of us.
Not all of us. That's true. You know, there's not room for 8 billion people on clusters.
But I find it funny that I wanted to address this flow state because I think it's the point that that I connected most with your book, because I'm
really happy to hear you say that, because there are some people who think, what is this guy on? I mean, actually, some people who know me quite well found that flow stuff quite difficult to take. So I'm happy, Aristide, but yeah, go on.
Well, I mean, I'm an avid surfer.
Okay, so you know.
I experienced this, or going to the mountains as much as possible, I experienced this also, how difficult it is to learn something when you're in your late 20s, 30s, to discover from scratch and to battle your own youth behind you in order to, you know. And I find the happiness.
Your youth is not behind Aristide. Believe me, you know, there's nobody else listening. Your youth is not behind you.
No, I know, but
mine is.
I have friends that learned, you know, skiing and surfing and all that at 10 years old.
I know. You're not going to do that again. That's true.
And I feel I've learned so much through it. And it's perhaps it's the moments I'm the most happy, when I'm with family and when I, you know, I'm in the ocean and feel alone. It's the only times where you can disconnect with, you know, the vanity and, you know, writing the paper or whatever.
That's the interesting thing. That's the interesting thing to me. It's not, you know, I introduced it and it emerged in my life in relation to a very specific thing, which was tennis. But actually, when you go looking for it, you find it in all sorts of places. And as you say, you know, family and social environments is one of the places where people do experience flow. And we actually, some of the work we've done in CUSP has kind of identified some of those areas where you can achieve that flow. And they're very, very different from each other. Some of it is physical exercise. Some of it is craft and being absorbed in a task. Some of it is social and in the presence of other people. Some of it is meditative, contemplative. And so, you know, I guess this, in a way, there's something in there for everybody.
Yeah, certainly.
And that's, it should, yeah. And that's kind of, I mean, in a way, isn't that what we're looking for? We're looking for, you know, not a good life, one size fits all, that everybody's got to do this, do that, and do the other, but actually something that is free to everybody, available to everybody, that can create opportunities for everyone. And that, you know, I think that's why that concept is in there.
And it's investment to yourself, as you mentioned it in this, which takes a lot of time. So if I had to synthesize your book, you kind of do it yourself at the very last chapter. You say that more is not always a virtue. Struggle is not only the only basis for existence. Competition is not the only response to struggle. And then you say that productivity doesn't exhaust the return to work. Investment is not a meaningless accumulation of financial wealth. This denial is not the only response to our mortality. And so, are these the precepts of post-growth, or how would you, if you had to give, you know, some pointers towards
the... I think they're the foundations of post-capitalism in a way. They're kind of, you know, all of those things really were saying, were kinds of things that if you like, they opposed the dogma that capitalism imposes on us, that work is a form of slavery, that productivity is all that it's about, that, you know, investment is a kind of casino where we gamble and the winner takes all. You know, the structure of late capitalism has imposed a set of dysfunctionalities on human society. And in that phrase, in that passage that you just read, I'm just kind of pointing that up, really, that the journey of the book shows actually what a poor conception of work, for example, lives inside capitalism. And that there is actually one, and it's the one that I draw from Hannah Arendt in the book and her philosophy. There is one which actually is very much about the enrichment of the human soul and the security of our sense of self and our participation in society. And we've given these goods up to the service of a capitalism that just sees rapacious growth as its output and efficiency as its only core driver. And so I guess by the time you're reading that at the end of the book, I guess that's what I'm hoping people will will understand, but understand not in a, you know, kind of, you know, intellectual here's my argument way, but in a sense of all of that history of ideas and the ways in which that's been explored in our very own cultural history. We're not trying to necessarily reinvent the whole world. We're actually drawing the threads of a different kind of narrative that already exists and has been laid down with extraordinary elegance by some of the most intelligent people. And that, you know, I think as you mentioned at the beginning, is to me is a kind of, you know, it gives me this sense, enormous sense of support. There've been moments in thinking about growth and challenging growth and when Prosperity Without Growth was first published, where you kind of think, you know, God, I'm putting my head up above the parapet here and I'm just about to be shot. And that's not the case. That, you know, that legacy of thought exists in our own culture and in other cultures. And it gives us actually the grounds, not just for thinking about and writing about post-growth society, and not just believing in it either, but actually sensing it, feeling it, and living it.
It feels very poetic, of course. So we're really looking forward to this post-growth society. This podcast is mainly focused on cities. So I was wondering if you can find, or how do you envision a post-growth city, given that cities are really the hub of consumption? So, and the place of accumulation, the place of, you know, the surplus, all of the surplus is cities exist through surplus. So have you ever thought of what would a city, a village, would it be a city? Would it be a village? What would be this post-growth territory, or how would it look like? Do you have any idea?
I think it can exist in different places. Am I allowed to say that I don't really know the answer to that question, Aristide? I mean, I kind of have some inkling of it, you know, and I think in a way, there's a lot of creativity at the moment about visually imagining those places. And you know, if you go to some of the people who have begun to do that, you find this sort of richness of imagery of the way that nature and city merge together, the way that people and function work, the way that work and life are put together, the energy dependencies of the city, that I think, you know, those visual images actually to me are incredibly powerful, and they answer your question a lot better, I think, than I could do in practice. You know, in practice, we know, you know, I could go back, if you like, to the sort of instruction manual of Prosperity Without Growth and say, you know, we have to know what the limits are. We have to fix the economics. We have to change the social logic. All of those things are broken. This is what you do with enterprises, what you do with investment, blah, blah, blah. And I think all of those things are true in relation to rebuilding cities. But I think in a way, to me, a lot of the really interesting work, there's two bits of interesting work. One is the people on the ground who are actually doing it at city level. And then there's the visionaries, if you like, the people who are imagining that, giving us stories, visual stories and cues about the kinds of places that we might be living in. And that's, you know, that's I think those are tasks which actually other people do much better than I do. What I hope I've given to that in a way is that re-envisaging of the cities of the future is supported by a rich history of ideas, which actually is enormously liberating, even though it starts from the idea that we might be living within certain limits.
So two last questions before I leave you. Now that you gave birth to this book, what will you do in 2021? What's your next?
I have a very specific task, actually, which I'm kind of working on with some researchers. I have to go and talk to them kind of right now, which is, you know, it seems to me that if we're right, that one of the messages from the lockdown is that health is more important than wealth, then we have to make an economy of care work. And it's been difficult because of the structures of capitalism, and most of the economics of care is not working properly. So that's a quite specific project, and it goes back in a way, you know, sadly, it tears me back into the mathematician and the philosopher and the policymaker and so on. But I, you know, it's a task actually that is absolutely essential. And when you think about the people who basically saved our lives over the course of the pandemic, many of them were working in the health sector, and yet they had been living, you know, under deprived conditions, precarious lifestyles, productivity targets that made their work more and more difficult. And all of that is driven by the structure of the economy that we have. And so there is a kind of urgent task, it seems to me, which is to find an economics and an economic structure of care and that allows us to create not necessarily at this point just a post-growth society, but a post-pandemic society in which the people who matter most are never again neglected in the way that they were in the time running up to the pandemic.
I do enjoy graphs, so don't be shy with graphs. And
it's good. You know, Herman Daly has a wonderful thing which he calls misplaced concreteness, and it's just fantastic. I love it. You know, when you're sitting in front of a spreadsheet or a computer model, the time goes by. You're in flow, and you never really have to worry too much about reality as long as you can produce some pretty graphs at the end of it.
I like it. Just the last question. So what you already mentioned, a great variety of books, of authors, of films as well. Is there anything is there one book or one article, one video that you would like to recommend that embodies post-growth?
I'm not sure really. Is there one? I mean, you know, it's really interesting to look at that video of Robert Kennedy, you know, the beginning of that video where he talks about the limitations of the GDP.
Is that available now somewhere?
It is. It's on. Yeah. There's a link in the references. There should be a link in the references in the book. And I did do that actually. There were points where I just felt, you know, actually the notes are as important as the book for those who really want the detail, because there's lots of notes and there's lots of links. And actually, almost as I think about the way that I wrote the book, it was by reference to a lot of visual material. So stuff that you can go, that is well archived and that you can go, hopefully the links are all still working from the notes in the book. But if you go there, and there's a couple of moments. So that moment with Bobby Kennedy was one. And then there's this moment, which I actually tried to write about in the book, because it's just an extraordinary moment to me of 3 days after Martin Luther King was shot, Nina Simone gives a wonderful concert, and in the middle of this concert, it was just a sort of tribute to King, and in the middle of it, she just stops and she does this total ad lib comment on where things are, on society, on life, on immortality. And it's, you know, to me, particularly as I was kind of looking at that in the middle of what emerged last summer, the kind of Black Lives Matter movement in particular, and realizing that the history of these ideas, the history of these struggles is not one thing at one time, but a continuous story that we are all engaged in. And each of those visual moments for me was part of what anchored me to that idea that we're sort of living in a chain of being, and the chain of ideas within that chain of being. And we're not individuals, and we're not, we are and we're not. You know, on one hand, we can play wonderful tennis or surf in extraordinary ways, but at the same time, a part of our well-being, an enormous part of our well-being, comes from our connection to other people. And so I chose lots of those videos to almost act as a kind of inspiration for me as I was writing, and hopefully they'll also be a kind of resource for other people as well.
Thanks so much for all your time, Tim. It was wonderful.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
I hope we're going to meet for some tennis or for some surf in the
future.
Oh,
you good. Are you going to teach me to surf? Really?
Sure.
That's
sure,
fantastic. Sure. I've always wanted to, but I've never actually stood up vertically on a surfboard. Yeah,
you don't need to have fun. So
okay,
yeah,
that's good.
So thanks everyone as well to listen until the end. If you like this episode, please make sure to share it with your friends and colleagues. And I'm looking forward for your new report, Tim. Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Bye.